Welcome, everyone. Ready to dive into India's rise as a global power, especially since 1991. We've got a fascinating mix lined up for you today. Everything from those historical records and economic data to, you know, architectural insights, and even a peek into India's vibrant cultural scene.
It's like piecing together a puzzle, right? But one with so many sides, it reveals India's, well, multifaceted role in world affairs.
Exactly. So the big question is, how did India, with its incredibly deep and complex history, navigate this modern world of globalization, especially in these last few decades?
Well, first, it's important to remember that globalization, it isn't a new concept for India at all. I mean, think about those ancient trade routes connecting India to the Roman and Chinese empires centuries ago. Globalization's been woven into India's story for, well, centuries.
You're right. We tend to think of it as a recent thing, this globalization, but India's history really shows us it's been a recurring theme.
Precisely. Take, for example, the Kushana Empire around the first century AD. They created this, well, unique cultural blend. It was a fusion of Indian, Persian, and Greek elements, sometimes called the Asian synthesis. This wasn't just about trade, though. It was about the exchange of ideas, art, even religious practices, an early form of cultural globalization, really.
That's a fantastic point. But then, of course, we have the period of British colonialism. How did that era, with all its complexities, shape India's path towards becoming a global power?
Yeah, colonialism, it undeniably left its mark. The British East India Company's influence in the 18th and 19th centuries was, well, massive. They restructured India's economy, put in new infrastructure, and even introduced Western education, although with their own, you know, motives. It's a complicated legacy, a mix of exploitation, sure, but also lasting changes that inadvertently prepared India for a more interconnected world.
It's interesting how historical events, they can have such ripple effects, right? On one hand, you have economic exploitation, cultural suppression, but then on the other, you have the groundwork being laid for things like modern administration and a more unified infrastructure.
Exactly. Now, fast forward to 1947. India gains independence. New chapter, for sure, but also a time of immense challenges. The country is grappling with poverty, food shortages, and just finding its footing in a, well, rapidly evolving global order.
So 1947, it wasn't some magical solution, more like the start of a whole new set of challenges.
Absolutely. And then we get to 1991, a pivotal year. India embraces economic liberalization. It's a conscious decision, you know, to enter the globalized world, not as a struggling post-colonial nation, but as a, well, a potential economic force.
This is where things get really interesting for our deep dive, right? 1991 feels like the turning point where India actively chooses to become a global player.
Exactly. And we see this reflected in India's economic growth. Looking at the data from 1921 onwards, there's this fascinating trend. Initially, stagnant population growth, followed by this period of steady growth, then a phase of rapid growth, and finally, from 1981 to 2011, we see high economic growth, although, you know, with a declining trend. These demographic and economic shifts really mirror those broader historical and political changes.
So what changed specifically in 1991? Was it a sudden boom or was it more gradual? Did certain industries, you know, experience a surge?
It was a mix of things, really. The government introduced some major policy changes, reducing tariffs, encouraging foreign investment, and deregulating various sectors. The automobile industry is a great example. You see these global giants like BMW and Audi setting up shop in India alongside domestic companies like Tata Motors. It wasn't just about bringing in foreign brands, though. It was about creating this, well, competitive landscape that fostered innovation and growth.
So it's not just about economics. India's also been strategically strengthening its position on the world stage through diplomacy as well. What are some of the key diplomatic strategies India has used?
India's been actively forming strategic partnerships and trade agreements with, well, key nations around the world. For example, their Look East policy, started in the early 1990s, sought to strengthen ties with Southeast Asian nations, both economically and strategically. And more recently, India has become a key player in the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad, along with the United States, Japan, and Australia, you know, reflecting their growing influence in the Indo-Pacific region. These partnerships are all about using economic and geopolitical strength to secure India's interests and, you know, project its power on that global stage.
That makes sense. They're strategically aligning themselves with key players in a way that, well, benefits everyone involved. But what about India's cultural impact? That feels like a big part of the equation, too.
You're absolutely right. India's cultural exports, from Bollywood films and those classical dance forms to things like yoga and cuisine, have a, well, global reach. This soft power, as it's often called, plays a crucial role in shaping perceptions and, you know, enhancing India's global image.
It's like India is sharing its vibrant cultural tapestry with the world, and the world is, well, embracing it. Do you think this cultural influence translates into any tangible diplomatic or economic advantages for India?
I think it certainly does. Think about it. When people around the world experience Indian culture, whether it's through a Bollywood movie or a yoga class, it creates this sense of, well, familiarity and connection. It fosters a positive image of India, which can lead to, you know, stronger diplomatic ties, increased tourism, and even better trade relations.
That's a great point. But it's not just about exporting a static culture, is it? There's this constant evolution happening within India as well, like, for instance, the way language has evolved.
Oh, absolutely. Languages in India, they have this fascinating history of interaction and, well, evolution. So Sanskrit, this ancient language, has influenced regional languages like, you know, Tamil, Telugu, and Bengali, creating this incredibly dynamic linguistic landscape. It's a beautiful example of tradition and change kind of intertwining, reflecting India's ability to absorb and adapt influences while still, you know, preserving its unique identity.
Speaking of tradition, how have those early religious movements like the Bhakti movement, with its emphasis on, well, personal devotion, how have they influenced India's identity?
The Bhakti movement, which emerged around the 6th century AD, had a really profound impact on Indian society. It challenged those rigid social hierarchies and emphasized a more personal and direct connection with, you know, the divine. This movement, it resonated deeply across India, influencing not only religious practices, but also, you know, art, literature, and music, really contributing to a distinct Indian identity.
It's amazing how these cultural and religious movements have shaped India's identity over, well, centuries. But let's maybe shift gears a bit and delve deeper into the impact of British colonialism, particularly on India's social and economic structures. We touched upon it earlier, but I'm curious to explore the, you know, the long-term consequences of those colonial policies.
That's a crucial aspect to understand. British colonial policies, while they were aimed at consolidating their control and, you know, extracting resources, they had these profound and often unintended consequences for India's, well, social fabric and economic development. One example that really illustrates this is the Cornwallis Code of 1793, introduced in Bengal.
What was so significant about this Cornwallis Code?
The Cornwallis Code, it introduced the concept of permanent land settlement, a system that, you know, dramatically changed the existing land ownership patterns. The British, in their attempt to, well, streamline revenue collection, they empowered the zamindars, the traditional landholders, and granted them, you know, hereditary rights over the land. While this might seem like a simple administrative change, it really had these far-reaching implications.
So what were some of the unintended consequences of this land settlement system? Did it create any, you know, social or economic imbalances?
Absolutely. Before the British, the rights and responsibilities associated with land, they were more, well, dispersed. You had the peasant cultivator, the zamindar, and the government, all with a stake in the land. This system, while, you know, not perfect, it had a degree of balance. But the Cornwallis Code, by transforming the zamindar into a figure closer to a, well, British landlord, it disrupted this balance.
So they were trying to impose a system that didn't quite fit the, well, the existing social structure, right?
Exactly. And this misalignment led to, you know, numerous issues down the line, disputes over land ownership, increased exploitation of peasant cultivators, and even in some cases, the displacement of communities. It also contributed to the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of, well, those zamindars, yeah, leading to social stratification and economic inequality.
It's a stark reminder that policies, even those implemented with, you know, seemingly good intentions, can have unintended consequences, especially when they're imposed upon a different cultural and social context. It seems like this British attempt to, well, impose order ultimately contributed to the rise of Indian nationalism in the late 19th and early 20th century.
You're absolutely right. The experience of colonialism with its inherent power imbalances and the erosion of, you know, traditional systems, it fueled this growing sense of Indian nationalism. Organizations like the Indian Association, founded in 1876, they began advocating for greater Indian representation in government and demanding more control over their own affairs.
So this sense of, well, national identity, it was a direct response to British rule a way of reclaiming agency and asserting their right to, you know, self-determination.
Precisely. Colonialism, it forced Indians to grapple with their own identity in a world that was, you know, dominated by European powers. What did it mean to be Indian? What values and traditions united them? These questions became central to the, well, the nationalist movement.
And it wasn't a, you know, a homogenous movement, was it? Different groups within India, they had different visions for the future.
Yes, that's crucial to remember. The Indian nationalist movement, while united in its opposition to British rule, it was, well, diverse and multifaceted. You had the Indian National Congress advocating for a unified and independent India, and later the Muslim League, which emerged as a powerful voice for, you know, a Muslim community, ultimately leading to the partition of India and the creation of Pakistan in 1947.
A tragic and, well, complex event.
Mm-hmm.
But even amidst those divisions, we see this incredible drive for self-determination, this, you know, this unwavering desire to shape their own destiny.
And that drive, that spirit of self-reliance, it's key to understanding India's role in, you know, international affairs today.
So we've discussed the British Raj's influence, the rise of nationalism, and those challenges to partition. How did India navigate those, you know, early decades after independence? How did they begin to assert themselves on that global stage?
The early decades after independence, they were a period of nation building and consolidation. India, it faced these immense challenges, poverty, food shortages, and this, you know, rapidly evolving global order. They had to prioritize basic needs and just find their place in this, well, this new world. It wasn't a time for, you know, grandstanding or aggressive power projection.
So it wasn't a case of India immediately stepping onto the world stage and, you know, flexing its muscles.
Not in the, well, conventional sense. But even in those early years, you see glimpses of India's, you know, future ambitions and its unique approach to global affairs. Jawaharlal Nehru, India's first prime minister, he championed the idea of non-alignment during the Cold War. He envisioned India as this, you know, moral force in the world, not beholden to any superpower, charting its own course.
It sounds like another delicate balancing act, mm-hmm. navigating between these, you know, global giants while staying true to their own principles.
Exactly. And they weren't simply withdrawing from the world. India was actively engaging with other, well, newly independent nations, particularly in Africa and Asia. Nehru, he saw India playing this leadership role in what became known as the non-aligned movement.
Didn't that movement gain some, well, significant momentum in the 1960s and 70s, attracting countries from, like, all over the world?
Yes. The non-aligned movement, it provided a platform for countries that wanted to, well, stay out of that Cold War rivalry to promote peace, cooperation, and development. India played a key role in shaping that conversation, advocating for a more, you know, equitable and just world order.
So even amidst its own, you know, internal challenges, India was already thinking about its role on a global scale, laying the groundwork for its future influence.
Precisely. And those efforts, combined with those economic liberalization policies that were implemented in 1991, they set the stage for India's emergence as the global power that we see today. But that, as they say, is a story for our next segment.
We've covered a lot of ground, from ancient trade routes to the complexities of colonialism and those challenges of, you know, independence. What struck you most about India's journey so far?
What fascinates me is the sheer, well, resilience of India. Despite centuries of, you know, foreign influence and internal challenges, India has maintained this, you know, distinct cultural core and an unwavering spirit of self-determination. It's this unique blend of tradition and modernity, of continuity and change that really makes India's story so compelling.
It's like a tree with, you know, deep roots, able to weather any storm and still reach for the sky. But as we move into that post-1991 era, how did India translate this resilience and its newfound economic dynamism mm-hmm. into, you know, concrete action on the world stage?
That's a great question, and one we'll delve into as we explore India's increasingly prominent role in international affairs after 1991.
Sounds like we're just getting started. Buckle up as we continue our deep dive into India's rise as a global powerhouse.
What's striking is how India's approach to globalization, well, after 1991, it wasn't just about those economic indicators or trade deals.
It was about, like, leveraging every part of their identity, you know,
yeah.
cultural, political, economic, all of it, to really make their mark on the world.
Exactly. Think about those Bollywood films. They're not just entertainment, are they? They're like a window into Indian society, its values, its aspirations, all of that.
And they've captivated audiences, well, literally worldwide, haven't they? It's like You experience this burst of color, music, emotion. It's infectious, really.
It's soft power at its finest, right? You get drawn into the world of the film and, in a way, into India itself. And it goes beyond film, too, of course. Yoga, for example. It's become, what, a global phenomenon?
Yeah.
Practiced by, what, millions now?
It's incredible. Something so deeply rooted in Indian tradition, and it's resonated with people, well, from all walks of life.
Yeah, it speaks to, you know, the universality of some of these human experiences, right? And the power of cultural exchange, too. And of course, we can't forget about Indian cuisine.
Oh, the aromas, those spices, the sheer variety. It's no wonder it's basically a global staple now.
Another example of how India is shaping global tastes and preferences. It's subtly influencing, well, how the world experiences flavor, food, all of that.
And it's not just a one-way street, is it? This cultural influence. India has also been open to influences from other cultures.
Absolutely. Look at the English language, for example. It's become interwoven into Indian society, used in education, government, even popular culture.
It's a reminder that globalization, it's this two-way process, right? A constant back and forth of ideas and influences.
And that brings us back to, you know, that question of balance. How does India navigate this exchange, you know, while preserving its unique identity in a world that's changing so rapidly?
It's a tough question, isn't it? How do you hold on to tradition while embracing change, especially with things like, well, technology, which are transforming India at an incredible pace?
Technology, it's a double-edged sword, right? On one hand, it's bridging those gaps, making knowledge more accessible, connecting India to the world in, well, in ways we've never seen before.
But on the other hand, you have those challenges too, like the digital divide and, well, the potential for cultural homogenization.
Exactly. It's this constant negotiation, a balancing act, really. Mm-hmm. But if there's one thing that India has shown, well, throughout its history, it's resilience and adaptability.
It's like this dance, you know, between tradition and modernity, finding harmony amidst all this constant change. Mm-hmm. So looking ahead, what do you see as the biggest opportunities and challenges for India on that global stage?
I think India is poised to become, well, an even more influential player. That young population, its growing economy, its technological prowess, these are all assets.
But they'll need to address those issues too, won't they? Things like poverty, inequality, environmental sustainability, those sorts of things.
Absolutely. Those are the internal challenges, and they're the ones that will shape their ability to project power and influence, you know, externally.
It's a good reminder that, well, domestic strength, that's really the foundation for global leadership.
Precisely. Yeah. And as India continues to navigate this, you know, complex global landscape, one thing is for sure, the world will be watching.
That's a perfect note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into India's journey to becoming a global powerhouse. It's a story that's still being written. This fascinating blend of history, culture, ambition, all of it.
And as you continue to explore India's role in, you know, international affairs, remember, it's a story of resilience, transformation, and a nation, well, constantly evolving and redefining itself on that world stage.
We hope you found this deep dive insightful and thought-provoking. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep diving deep.